Fluke, protested Rahul as other boys cheered and thumped his back. Watch me! I can do it again! Zerunisa came out to watch the game, wiping away tears as she considered her exuberant son. Mirchi seemed to have forgotten the pall he brought over the household by failing ninth grade. She considered him her brightest child, had even imagined him becoming a doctor. Now his unexpected failure brought the tally of Hussein household crises to 3. Her husband was in the hospital, struggling to breathe, and her eldest daughter, Kakashin, had run away from her husband of a year. Mirchi's cheerfulness had much to do with the return of his sister. All of the Hussein children had been elated to see her. It wasn't just that she could cook and clean in place of their mother, who spent most of her days at the hospital. To her younger brothers and sisters, Kakashin had been a second mother, a more organized, less exhausted version of the original. But she'd returned home with heartbreak in her eyes. Kakashin's husband was also her cousin. Zerunisa and one of her sisters had arranged the marriage when their children were 2. But Kakashin felt that the intimate photos in her husband's cell phone, of a woman not more beautiful than she, resolved a question that had troubled her since the wedding. Why didn't her new husband want to make love?
He told me once, it's because you go off to sleep too early, so I would stay up late, she told her mother. Then he stopped coming home at night. He says, don't correct me, you don't have any rights over me. What kind of life is this?
The women in her husband's family kept strict parda, stayed inside the house unless accompanied by a man.
So I sit home, entirely dependent on this man, she said, and then it turns out his heart was never with me.
Zerunisa hoped that her sister would be able to bring the husband back in line. But to her daughter's urgent question,
how is it possible to force someone to love me?
She had no answer, because the faults of her own husband did not include a lack of love. The Hindu cricketers took note of Kakashin's return, deciding that the Muslim girl's resplendent looks trumped the taint of her goat-eating and dwelling amid garbage, especially now that she was presumed not to be a virgin. Boys stared into her hut. Kakashin averted her eyes. She sometimes wished, for peace's sake, that she was plainer. Zerunisa blamed Fatima for drawing such dogs in heat to the family doorstep. She'd managed to beat away one of Fatima's lovers, who kept drifting over to leer at her daughter, but he was frail from a heroin habit. Other men might fight back. Fatima would sit on her neck, too, with Kakashin crushed, Mirchi a failure, toddlers to chase after, her husband in the hospital, and a fever she couldn't get rid of. Zerunisa lacked the energy for a fight with the one leg. Zerunisa tried not to judge the private morality that Fatima had developed. She knew the woman craved affection and respect. But especially when Zerunisa considered Fatima's children, her own respect drained away. Recently, Fatima had gone at her 8-year-old, Nuri, so hard with the crutches that Zerunisa and another woman had to tackle her. And then there was Fatima's 2-year-old, Medina. After the little girl got TB, Fatima had become obsessed about catching the disease herself. Then Medina had drowned in a pail.
I was in the toilet when it happened, Fatima had claimed to Zerunisa.
But shared walls leak secrets, one of which was that, when Medina drowned in a very small hut, Fatima and her mother were there. Fatima's 6-year-old daughter, Hina, had also been on hand, and said afterward,
Medina was a very nice sister until that day.
Zerunisa had paid for the funeral shroud and the burial plot, and tried to convince herself that Medina's death had in fact been an accident. She thought about her own children, and how she didn't know what they were up to half the time. The police came to Anawadi one day to ask about Medina's death, an inquiry quickly closed. Young girls in the slums died all the time under dubious circumstances, since most slum families couldn't afford the sonograms that allowed wealthier families to dispose of their female liabilities before birth. Sickly children of both sexes were sometimes done away with because of the ruinous cost of their care. 1-year-old Danush, who lived 2 lanes over from the Husseins, had gotten an infection in the filthy public hospital where he was born. His skin peeled off, and the touch of a sheet made him scream. His family took loan after loan at usurious interest, spending 15,000 rupees trying to cure him. Then, one night in March, his father had beaten back his wife and emptied a pot of boiling lentils on the baby in his sari sling cradle. Asha's son Rahul had jumped smack into the middle of that horror show, had run to get the police. Zerunisa admired the hell out of Rahul for that. The Noosh reached a hospital and survived. Now Zerunisa ached every time she saw him, that grave, unblinking eye in a burn-mapped face. After Medina drowned, Fatima seemed oddly liberated. Other women said the worst of her, and she found that she didn't much care. She drew on dramatic black eyebrows, shellacked her cheeks with powder.
"Spent 50 rupees to turn into a white lady," the Hussein boys whispered,
and picked up a fresh set of lovers.
"Did you see how that guy and his friend are looking at me?"
she would say to Zerunisa.
"Are you jealous? No man looks at you."
The men she invited inside found her beautiful, she told her neighbor. Said there was no woman like her in all of India. Said she deserved a nicer life than she had. The Husseins felt for Fatima's husband, who sorted garbage in another slum, earning 100 rupees for a 14-hour day. Mirchi put it bluntly.
"She treats that old man like a shoe."
The shoe often came over to complain about his wayward wife, and one night Zerunisa had teased him.
"Idiot, you should have asked me before you married. I could have picked you a nice Muslim woman with 2 legs who would raise your children and run your household properly."
Mistake. Thin walls. Fatima was in her face, crutches waving.
"Who are you to call me a bad wife?"
Still, when Fatima and her husband fought, she would call out Zerunisa's name, and Zerunisa would go, sighing, to separate the miserable couple, just as she sighed on Eid and other Muslim holidays before inviting them to share her mutton korma. The family of the child-abusing Fatima, the family of the skeezy brothel owner, this was the Muslim fellowship she had in Annawadi.
"It's easy to break a single bamboo stick, but when you bundle the sticks, you can't even bend them," she told her children. "It's the same with family and with the people of our faith. Despite the petty differences, Muslims have to join up in big sufferings, and for Eid."
Black clouds hunched over the hills west of the city, but didn't break. Annawadi children kept flinging their inner tubes toward the flagpole, and one July morning, Abdul's father watched the game from his doorway, beaming. His shirt hung as loosely as ever off his shoulders, but Fatima and the other neighbors marveled when they saw his face. Garbage proceeds had financed a 2-week stay in a small private hospital where he'd breathed oxygen instead of foul slum air. Karam was shining. He looked nea takatak, brand new.
"I can't believe it," the Tamil woman who ran the liquor still told Zerunisa. 10 years gone from his face, like that. He looks like some Bollywood hero, Salman Khan."
"He ought to look good," said Zerunisa. "We paid 20,000 rupees to that hospital. But it's true, he got so young, like a boy. I see him from the corner of my eye, and I think, oh shit, I forgot that I had another child. Now I will have to arrange another marriage. Allah knows I have enough marriages to do already."
The next marriage would be Abdul's. Though the financials remained to be worked out, she and her husband had settled on a likely girl, the 16-year-old daughter of a scrap dealer in Sakinaka, the industrial slum where Abdul sold his goods. The girl was pretty, no moles evident. Crucially, she was habituated to filthy men. She had come to the house 3 times, demure in a burqa, her younger sister in tow. From what Mirchi could make out, this younger sister was extremely hot, and in her honor he painted a large red heart on the front of the family hut. Mirchi claimed to be eager for marriage. One day, well out of his father's earshot, he said,
"Mother, I want a wife just like you. She'll do all the work and I'll do nothing."
But Abdul was as cautious about marrying as he was about everything else.
"I hear of this love so often that I think I know it, but I don't feel it, and I myself don't know why," he fretted. "These people who love, and then the girlfriend goes away, they cut their arms with a blade, they put a cigarette butt out in their hand, they won't sleep, they won't eat, they'll sing.
they must have different hearts than mine. He told his parents, "You don't hold a hot iron in your palm, do you? You let it cool. You think on it slowly."
"No, I think we should marry him quickly,"
Zerunisa told her husband as she cooked lunch a few days after his homecoming. He'd asked for meat to build his strength, and she was crouched on the floor, breastfeeding Lalu while stirring a cartilaginous stew.
"A marriage would make him happy, I think. So much turmoil inside him. I don't think he's been happy for a single day in Annawadi."
"Who is happy living here?" her husband replied, fishing a silver foil packet of prednisolone from a plastic bag of medicines he tacked on the wall. "Am I happy? All around us, third-class people, and no one with whom I can relate. Does anyone here even know of the American war in Iraq? All they know of is each other's business. But I don't complain to you. Why is Abdul complaining?"
"Do you know your own son? He says nothing, just does his work, does what we ask him. But why is it only his mother who sees that he is sad?"
"He will be happier when we go to Vasai," he replied.
"Happier in Vasai,"
she quietly repeated, with a sarcasm he chose to ignore. The small plot of land on which they'd made a deposit in January was an hour and a half farther outside the city, in a community of construction suppliers and industrial recyclers. Many of its residents were Muslims from the Uttar Pradesh district in which Karam had been raised on the Nepal border. He'd learned of the Vasai community from a Muslim developer so given to religious disquisition that Mirchi and Abdul called him the Imam, rolling their eyes. The first time Karam visited the place, he'd been struck by a group of men clutching newspapers and speaking animatedly at a tea stall. He imagined they were discussing the black man in the United States who was trying to become the country's president. Karam had heard that this Obama was secretly a Muslim and was rooting for him. The dirt roads twisting upward from the tea stall had been giddy with chickens, which reminded him of his native village. He wasn't sentimental about that village, in a district where there was little work except in sugarcane fields and where children died at a higher rate than in any other district in India. But he felt that urban slums surrounded by affluence turned children contemptuous of their parents. "Because we can't give them the brand name clothes, the car." He considered it fortunate that Mirchi was merely lazy, not a defiant consumer of a race X. But there were six other children after Mirchi. To Karam, Vasai was the ideal village-city hybrid, a place where opportunity and parental respect weren't mutually exclusive. "And at least there they would not be insulted for their religion," he told his wife. Zerunisa felt it premature to invest their dreams for their children in a part-owned bit of dirt that lacked even four bamboo poles and a tarp under which to sleep.
"Our ghost house," she'd taken to calling the property.
She'd given him permission to make the deposit. He always consulted her on financial decisions, since the results had been dire the two times he ignored her advice. But it irritated her that he hadn't yet taken her to see the land.
"How can I take you with all these children to care for?" he'd been saying all year.
But Kekashin was now here to help, and she still hadn't seen the place. She wondered if the community was so like his native village that it had gotten him to thinking like the conservative Muslim men who lived there. Before her husband's hospitalization, the developer had visited to discuss the property payments. She'd worn her burqa, served tea, then crouched in a corner as her mother had done in Pakistan. Covered and unseen by men outside her family was the way Zerunisa had expected to live out her adult life. But shortly after marriage brought her to Uttar Pradesh, she was working the sugarcane fields, at night, among men. She had prayed constantly for her husband's TB to relent so that she could go back into Parda.
"I couldn't even speak in those days," she told her children. "I was scared of the whole world."
Having a man to deal with that world on her behalf had seemed to her a fine thing. She had stopped praying for a return to Parda after Kekashin was born. She believed in focusing her requests to Allah, troubling him with only one matter at a time. So she prayed for the health of Kekashin, and then for the health of Abdul, who entered the world in a pile of dirt by the Intercontinental Hotel. Her husband had brought the family to Mumbai in hopes of finding work less strenuous than farming. Renting a pushcart to transport waste to recyclers was the work he could find. Abdul had been a sulky infant,
refused his mother's breast as often as he took it. But he had survived, unlike the next boy. Then Mirchi came, fat and pretty, followed by 6 more, also healthy. Nothing in Zerunisa's life had brought her more satisfaction than the fact that her children took after her, not her husband, and their haleness. Not an undersized one in the lot, after Abdul. Soon, one of the younger boys would prove clever enough to take over her role in Abdul's business, negotiating with scavengers, thieves, and police. Then she would gladly stay in the house. But to go back to Parda? It had belatedly dawned on her that this might be expected in Versailles. It would exacerbate her husband's condescension, a quality sufficiently annoying that she had to snap at him from time to time.
"Just because I can't read, you pretend to everyone that you're the hero in this family and I am the nothing," she said to him recently. "Like I would have been stuck in my mother's womb without you to get me out. Go, act like this big-time sharif, but it is I who have been managing everything."
Anawadi's lack of censorious conservative Muslims allowed her to call out her husband when necessary, just as it had allowed her to work to feed her children. Such freedoms would be painful to give up.
"In your mind, you've already moved to Versailles," she told her husband,
ladling out the stew and handing it over with the economy of motion people develop when living in small, overpopulated huts.
"Maybe you should pack up and go. And then go to Saudi. Oh, there you can really relax. But this house is where your wife and children live. Look at it. You also felt ashamed when that imam came over."
Walls bloated and watermarked from flooding. Uneven stone floor with a hoard of recyclables in every corner, and more recyclables beneath an iron bed they'd recently purchased because Karam's breathing improved when he slept a foot higher than the trash. But had he slept like a bat on the ceiling, there would be no escaping the smell. Trash, stale cooking smoke, and the olfactory traces of 11 human beings who lacked sufficient water to get clean.
"I'd like to leave this place too," Zerunisa said. "But where do your children grow up? In the ghost house?"
He looked at her, confused. All last night, all morning, she had been affection itself. But Zerunisa had had an idea and sensed an auspicious moment when her husband came out of the hospital. It had nothing to do with the position of the moon and the stars. It had to do with the shortness of life and a break in the rains.
"Do you remember how anxious you were in the hospital?" she said. "Thinking, what if you were to leave this family?"
He had told her then, "I fear God is inviting me in." Karam nodded, frowning.
"So?" "He let you out this time," she paused. "Do I work hard for this family? Do I ask for jewelry?"
"No," he admitted, "you don't ask." She was less and less sure she wanted to go to Versailles. Less and less sure her husband would live to get there. She wanted a more hygienic home, here, in the name of her children's vitality. She wanted a shelf on which to cook without rat intrusions. A stone shelf, not some cast-off piece of plywood. She wanted a small window to vent the cooking smoke that caused the little ones to cough like their father. On the floor, she wanted ceramic tiles like the ones advertised on the Beautiful Forever wall. Tiles that could be scrubbed clean instead of broken concrete that harbored filth in each striation. With these small improvements, she thought her children might stay as healthy as children in Anawadi could be. Before she'd even finished making her petition, her husband had assented, setting into motion the chain of contingency that would damage 2 families forever. The Husseins would spend some of their savings to make a decent home. The next day, typically, Karam was acting as if the renovation had been his own idea. In this instance, a happy wife let her husband's nonsense go. Chapter 6. The Hole She Called a Window. The little Husseins grasped the seriousness of the house renovation when their parents kept them home from school, now back in session. For the next 3 days, even 6-year-old hands would have assignments, the first of which was to drag everything in their hut onto the Maidan. The rusty bed came out first, and Karam and Zerunisa settled in, guarding their possessions from passerby while watching Abdul direct his sibling labor crew.
"Finally, My kitchen,
Zerunisa said, leaning into her husband, her headscarf slipping down to her shoulders.
Look at the Tahir,
said Karam after a while. Their third son was furiously stirring cement to keep it from hardening in the day's oppressive heat.
I despair because he has no brains, eighth grade and can't write the number eight. But he works hard, like Abdul, not afraid of labor.
He'll be okay, Zerunisa agreed.
Her fifth son, Safdar, was the child she worried about. He was dreamy and impractical, like her husband. He loved frogs, and in pursuit of them, sometimes swam the sewage lake. No one liked to sleep next to him after he did that. Asha's husband, Mahadeo, materialized at the bedside. Slight and weathered, he was monosyllabic when sober, as he'd been since Asha found a cleverer hiding place for her purse. In hopes of relieving this painful condition, he offered his construction skills to the Husseins for 100 rupees. Abdul, who didn't quite know what he was doing, was glad for Mahadeo's help. Asha was the only one in the family who unnerved him.
I think she's mad in her ambitions, Abdul's father had said a few nights earlier. She wants a shining public life, wants to be some big politician when her private life is so shameful. Does she think other people can't hear her fight with her husband at night?
Their fights were indeed as loud as the ones between Fatima the One Leg and her husband. Asha, it was rumored, always won. As Mahadeo and the Hussein children worked, some of Manju's students wandered over, curious. Manju would soon be calling them to class, but in the meantime, they perused the Hussein possessions piled up on the Maidan. Adults also came to look. Only a handful of neighbors had been inside the Hussein's hut, but to judge by the piles, the Muslim garbage people were less poor than had been assumed. Many Anawadians recalled how much the Husseins had lost in the 2005 deluge. Their youngest daughter had nearly drowned, and their clothing, rice stores, and savings of 5,000 rupees had washed away. Now they had a roughly carpentered wooden cupboard for their clothing, a cupboard twice as large as Asha's, a small television bought on an installment plan, 2 thick cotton quilts, one blue and white checked, one chocolate brown, 11 stainless steel plates, 5 cooking pots, fresh cardamom and cinnamon, superior to the spices most Anawadians used. A cracked mirror, a tube of Brill cream, a big bag of medicines. The rusty bed. Most people in the slum, Asha included, slept on the floor.
Everyone is jealous of us fixing our house, Kakashin explained to an older cousin who'd just arrived from the countryside. So let them be jealous, Zerunisa exclaimed. Why shouldn't we live in a better room now that we are doing a little better?
Still, she decided to entrust the television to the brothel keeper for the duration of the repair work. No onlooker asked, why fix a house when the airport authority might demolish it? Almost everyone here improved his hut when he was able, in pursuit not just of better hygiene and protection from the monsoon, but of protection from the airport authority. If the bulldozers came to flatten the slum, a decent hut was seen as a kind of insurance. The state of Maharashtra had promised to relocate those families who had squatted at the airport since 2000 to tiny apartments and high-rises. To Anawadians, a difficult-to-raise house increased the odds that a family's tenure on airport land would be acknowledged by the relocation authorities. And so they put their money into what would be destroyed. To Abdul, fixing the family hut seemed unwise for reasons that had nothing to do with the airport authority. To him, it was like standing on the roof bragging that a Muslim family was out-earning the Hindus. Why throw ghee on an open flame? His mother's new tile floor would in any case get carpeted in garbage. Had the family funds been at his disposal, he would have bought an iPod. Mirchi had told him about this iPod, and while Abdul knew little of music, he had been enchanted by the concept. A small machine that let you hear only what you wanted to hear. A machine to drown out your neighbors. The window that would let out the cooking smoke was finished the first day, and on the second day, the children turned to breaking the cracked stone floor and leveling it in preparation for tiles.
Ceramic tiles,
Zerunisa instructed her husband, who felt well enough to go and shop for them. 2-year-old Lalu,
unhappy at being excluded from the construction work, applied a rag to his father's shoes for the momentous outing. Shortly after noon, Karam put 2,000 rupees in his pocket and left for a small tile shop in Sakinaka. Abdul was glad to see him go. Delay was a specialty of his father, and Abdul hoped to finish the work by nightfall.
"You're all hammering too loud. I can't hear my radio,"
Fatima yelled through the wall after a while. The younger Hussein boys looked at one another, amused. Each of the last 3 times they'd made small repairs in their house, she'd thrown one of her famous fits.
"We're breaking the floor, putting in a kitchen," Zerunisa called back. "I wish the tiles and shelf would magically jump into place, but they won't, so there will be some noise today."
Abdul ignored the exchange, intent on his own problem. His mother's cooking shelf was driving him mad. The 4-foot gray slab was uneven, as was the floor, so the shelf wobbled perilously on 2 supports he'd built to hold it up. Nothing in this idiot house was straight. The only way to stabilize the shelf and make it level would be to cut into the brick wall, itself uneven, and cement the slab in place. Asha's husband being too hung over to work today, another neighbor had offered to help, for money up front. This man seemed wobbly too, but Abdul put it out of his head as the two of them began chipping away at the brick. Zerunisa said,
"We'll really hear from the one leg now."
30 seconds later, Fatima began to shout,
"What's happening to my wall?"
"Don't take tension, Fatima," Zerunisa called back. "We're doing the shelf now. Just give us this day. We also want it done fast, before the rains come."
Abdul kept working. He was a categorizer of people as well as garbage, and as distinctive as Fatima looked, he considered her a common type. At the heart of her bad nature, like many bad natures, was probably envy. And at the heart of envy was possibly hope, that the good fortune of others might one day be hers. His mother claimed that back when every life at Anawadi was roughly equal in its misery, neighborly resentments didn't get out of hand, though Zerunisa was known to be sentimental about history.
"You bastards! You're going to break down my wall!"
Fatima, again.
"Your wall," said Zerunisa, irritated. "We built this wall and never took a pesa from you. Shouldn't we be allowed to put a nail in it from time to time? Be patient. If anything happens on your side, we'll repair it once the shelf is in."
Fatima went quiet until bricks began crumbling on her side.
"There is rubble in my rice," she shouted. "My dinner is ruined. Sand is spraying everywhere."
Abdul was dismayed. The readiness of the bricks to disintegrate, long suspected, was now confirmed. They'd been made with too much sand, and the mortar between them had deteriorated. Crap bricks that weren't even glued to one another, less a wall than a tremulous stack. As he considered how to install the kitchen ledge without toppling the whole house, Zerunisa went outside. So did Fatima, and the 2 women started shoving each other. Neighbors came out to watch, the children debating which of the 2 women was more like the great Kali, an Indian fighter in the World Wrestling Entertainment franchise.
"If you don't stop breaking my house, motherfucker, I will put you in a trap,"
shouted Fatima.
"It's my wall to break, prostitute," Zerunisa shouted back. "If we'd waited for you to build a wall, we'd all still be seeing each other naked."
Abdul ran outside and pushed the 2 women apart. Taking his mother by the neck, he dragged her back home.
"Don't you have children?" he said, disgusted. "You're no better than the one leg, fighting outside in front of everyone."
Such scenes violated his first principle of Anawadi. Don't call attention to yourself.
"But she used bad language first," his mother protested. "This woman talks badly to her own man," Abdul said. "Would she hesitate to throw bad words at you? But you didn't have to throw them back at her. She has a crack in her. She's cracked. You know this."
Fatima was still swearing when she crossed the Maidan and departed Anawadi. Abdul heard female neighbors laughing at her as she went, but the things that females laughed at did not interest him. He registered only that Fatima's absence gave him a chance to finish installing the ledge in peace. Except that the neighbor he'd hired to help him had now collapsed, taking the slab down with him.
"You are drunk,"
Abdul accused his neighbor, who was pinned to the floor by the stone. The man could not deny it. He had advanced TB and explained,
"Lately, if I don't drink, I don't have the strength to lift anything."
Abdul felt like crying when he saw the wall's fresh degradation. Fortunately, the stone hadn't broken when it fell, and the neighbor seemed sobered by the accident. He assured Abdul that they could finish the job in an hour. Abdul calmed himself by imagining that if his mother had a nicer house, she might start practicing a nicer way of speaking. But now a neighbor arrived to report an extraordinary sight. Fatima, a woman with few rupees to spare, had been seen riding off in an auto rickshaw. Another report, 15 minutes later. Fatima was in the Sahar police station, accusing Zerunisa of violent assault.
"Allah," said Zerunisa, "when did she become such a liar?" "Go quickly," Kekashin told her mother. "If you don't get to the station fast, they will have only her story to judge by."
Karam returned home as his wife was departing. Tiles were more expensive than he'd realized, and he'd been 200 rupees short. She told him,
"Stop delaying. Get the money, buy the tiles. If the police come and see all that we have outside, they'll clean us out."
The younger boys were already picking up the family possessions and tossing them into the storeroom.
"Don't worry about me," Zerunisa told Abdul. "Just don't stop working. Get it done."
When Zerunisa reached the station, winded from the half-mile run, Fatima was sitting at a desk telling her story to a tall female officer named Kulkarni.
"This is the one who beat me, and you see I am a cripple with only one leg," Fatima said. "I did not beat her," Zerunisa protested. "So many people were outside watching, and not one would say I did. She came and started a fight. They broke my wall, got sand in my rice. She said she wanted to put us in a trap when all we do is work and mind our own business."
Fatima was crying, so Zerunisa turned on her own waterworks. The officer put up her palms.
"Are you women mad, bothering us like this? You think the police have nothing better to do than listen to you fighting about some small thing? We are protecting the airport. You, go home and cook your dinner and mind your children," she told Fatima.
To Zerunisa, she said,
"You sit over there."
Zerunisa took a seat on a row of bucket chairs and doubled over. Now her tears were real. Fatima had put her in a trap, as threatened. She would soon be back at Anawadi telling everyone that the police were holding Zerunisa like a common criminal. When she recovered from her bout of sobbing, Asha was in the seat beside her. Asha had been helping some police officers find a government-subsidized apartment in which to conduct a side business, brokering work for which she hoped to earn real money. The potential profit to be made by patching up a dispute between two Muslims would be small. However, if she didn't handle the petty conflicts at Anawadi, people would start turning to a woman from the Congress Party whom everyone called White Sari, and corporator Subhash Savant would hear about it. Asha met Zerunisa's eye. "For 1,000 rupees, Asha said, she'd convince Fatima to make no further trouble. The money wouldn't be for Asha herself. She would put it, some of it, in Fatima's hand. Asha wasn't always this explicit about money, but she felt she had to be with Zerunisa. Mirchi had once been picked up by the police for buying stolen goods, and Zerunisa had begged for Asha's help. Asha had impressed on the officers that Mirchi was a child and unwell, which happened to be true, for he had 6 badly infected rat bites on his butt. When Asha brought Mirchi home, Zerunisa had thanked her, as if she didn't know that Asha's help had become a business. But Zerunisa distrusted Asha as much as Asha distrusted her. Asha was Shiv Sena, anti-Muslim, like many of the officers in the station.
"We'll work it out with Fatima's husband," Zerunisa told Asha, concluding the conversation. "Thank you, but it will be fine."
An hour later, she started to believe it would be fine when Officer Kulkarni offered her a cup of tea and advice.
"You need to really beat the crap out of this one leg. Finish the matter once and for all." "Oh, but how can I beat her when she is a cripple?" "But if you don't beat people like that, you will have to deal with them over and over again. Just whack her, and I will handle it if she complains. Don't worry."
Zerunisa thought the officer's friendliness might also be a request for payment. A male officer named Tokle was less subtle. He regularly demanded bribes from the family, since people squatting on airport land were not allowed to run businesses.
"You owe me for so many months," he said when he saw her. "Have you been hiding from me? Now that you're here, we can settle your account."
Zerunisa had more money than Fatima. Extracting some of that money was probably why she, not Fatima, had been kept in the station. She would have to pay Tokle. He would shut down their business otherwise. But she decided to give Officer Kulkarni a wet-eyed look that conveyed enormous gratitude for the advice about beating her neighbor. Then she turned her attention to a cup of milky tea. It was dusk, and in Anawadi, Kekashin was fuming. Sitting in the clearing guarding the family's things, she could see her panicked brothers spading cement, trying to finish before the police showed up and asked for money. Kekashin could also see through Fatima's open door, where she was swaying on crutches to a cassette tape of Hindi film songs turned up loud. Upon returning from the police station, Fatima had painted her face more extravagantly than usual, a shining bindi on her forehead, black gajal around her eyes, red lipstick. She looked as if she were about to step onto a stage. Kekashin couldn't hold her tongue.
"The police are keeping my mother because of the lies that you told, and you're dressing up and dancing like some film heroine."
A fresh fight began on the Maidan.
"Bitch, I can put you in the police station too," Fatima shouted. "I won't leave it. I will put your family in a trap. Isn't what you've done enough? Getting my mother arrested? I should twist off your other leg for that."
The audience of neighbors reformed for this lively tamasha. No one had ever seen Kekashin angry. She was usually a mediator among Anawadi women. Now, with her flashing tear-spangled eyes, she looked like Parvati in that soap opera, Kahani Gargar Ki.
"You may twist my leg, but I'll do worse to you," Fatima said. "You say you are married, but where's your husband? Did he find out you prostitute yourself to other men?"
Hearing his daughter's virtue disparaged, Karam came outside. Being called a whore was not Kakashin's central worry. She said to her father,
"Have you lost track of the hour? It's almost night, and mother is still in the station." "Run and see if your mother is okay," Karam instructed Mirchi.
To Fatima, he said,
"Listen, beggar, we'll finish this work, then we stay out of each other's business forever."
Inside the hut, Abdul was bagging up shards of brick. The cooking shelf was now installed. For some days, Abdul had imagined his mother's pleasure at seeing it done. Instead, she was being held by the police. The floor was half rubble, half wet cement, awaiting tiles his father had not yet bought. The installment plan television, stored in the brothel keeper's house, had been broken by the man's son. Abdul's little brothers and sisters had been frightened by all the shouting, and his father, surveying the wreck of his home, appeared to be losing his mind. Suddenly, Karam stormed back to Fatima's doorway.
"Half-wit!" he shouted. "You lied and said my wife beat you, so now I'm going to make you recall what a real beating feels like!"
On second thought, he wouldn't do the hitting himself.
"Abdul!" he called to his son. "Come and beat her!"
Abdul froze. Though he had obeyed his father all his life, he wasn't about to hit a disabled woman. Fortunately, his older sister intervened.
"Father, calm down," she ordered. "Mother will handle this when she gets home."
Kekashin understood where the family authority resided in a crisis. As she led Karam home, he called over his shoulder,
"One leg, tell your husband that if this is how you treat our years of kindness, I want half of what we spent to make this wall."
"Yes, you will need your small change for your own funeral," Fatima replied. "I am going to hurt you all."
Mirchi soon returned from the police station reconnaissance. His mother, apparently unharmed, was sitting quietly with a female officer. Relieved, Kekashin started dinner. At this hour, cooking fires were being lit all over Anawadi, the spumes converging to form a great smoke column over the slum. In the Hyatt, people staying on the top floors would soon start calling the lobby.
A big fire is coming toward the hotel.
Or,
I think there's been an explosion.
The complaints about the cow dung ash settling in the hotel swimming pool would start half an hour later.
And now came one more fire, in Fatima's hut. Fatima's 8-year-old daughter, Nuri, had come home for dinner, but the wooden door wouldn't open when she pushed. Inside, a love song was blasting, and she thought her mother was so busy dancing she'd forgotten the hour. Nuri ran to get her mother's friend Cynthia. Cynthia couldn't open the door either, so she lifted Nuri up to a hole near the roof of the hut, a hole that Nuri proudly called their window.
What do you see, Nuri?
She's pouring kerosene on her head.
Don't, Fatima!
Cynthia yelled, trying to make her voice heard over the music. Seconds later, the film song was overwhelmed by a whoosh, a small boom, and an 8-year-old screaming,
My mother, on fire!
Kekashin shrieked. The brothel keeper was the first across the Maidan, 3 boys fast behind, throwing their weight against the door until it broke. They found Fatima thrashing on the floor, smoke pouring off her skin. At her side was a yellow plastic jug of kerosene, overturned, along with a vessel of water. She had poured cooking fuel over her head, lit a match, then doused the flames with water.
Save me!
She shouted. The brothel keeper tensed. Something low on Fatima's back was still burning. He grabbed a blanket and smothered the flame as a vast crowd formed outside the hut.
All day these Muslim garbage people have been fighting so loudly.
Didn't she think of her daughters before she did this?
She's okay now,
the brothel keeper announced, rolling away some cooking pots he'd knocked on top of her in his haste to extinguish the fire.
Alive, no problem.
He pulled Fatima up. When he let go, she flopped back down, howling. People took note of the upturned vessel of water.
She's a fool then, said an old man. She wanted to burn herself a little, create a drama, and instead she burned herself a lot.
It's because of these people that I have done this,
Fatima cried out, her voice astonishingly clear. Everyone knew which people she meant. Kekashin stopped sobbing long enough to issue a command to her brothers and father.
Run! Go! She said she was going to trap us. She might say we have set her on fire.
A police case now. They're finished, a neighbor said, watching the Hussein boys tear past the public toilet in the general direction of the Hotel Leela with its $800 suites.
Water!
Fatima was pleading. Her face was red and black.
But if she dies while you give her water, the ghost will get inside you, someone said.
Ghosts of women are the worst. Years go by and they don't leave you be.
A luckless teenage girl named Priya finally brought the water. Priya, one of the poorest girls in Annawadi, sometimes helped Fatima cook and care for her children in exchange for food. She was said to have 2 ghosts inside her already.
Stupid people. They say it's bad to give water after a burn.
This was a new voice, crisper than the others. Asha's voice. She was standing at the back of the crowd. People turned.
Then tell her not to drink, Asha! Stop her! But how do I snatch it away?
Asha said.
If it's her last moment, I don't want to take a dying woman's curse. What if she passed right then?
Manju came out. Her mother ordered her away. Manju's best friend, Mina, came closer. It was unspeakable what she saw. Fatima, writhing in a brown 2-piece outfit with pink flowers on the front and back, most of the flowers now burned away. Where the flowers had been, strips of skin were hanging. Mina ran away to be sick, felt she'd be sick her whole life, what she'd seen.
How will I get to the hospital?
Fatima was saying.
My husband isn't here.
Someone should get an auto rickshaw and take her to Cooper Hospital. All these idiots are just staring. She's going to die before our eyes.
But if you take her to Cooper, the police will say you were the one to set her on fire. Asha should take the one leg to the hospital, someone said. She's Shiv Sena. The police won't fuck with her.
Fatima's eyes zeroed in on Asha.
Teacher, she cried. How can I walk and go when I am like this?
I will pay for the auto rickshaw,
Asha replied.
But I have people waiting for me. I am too busy to go myself.
The other Anawadians watched as Asha strode back to her hut.
I offered to pay for the rickshaw, but why should I have gone?
Asha told her husband later, at home.
It was a fight between these garbage people, and who knows what happens when you get involved. Anyway, Zeru Nisa should have taken my offer of help at the police station. She doesn't understand the basic thing. You pay early, it costs less later on. You put money in the one leg's hand, like she's a beggar. You stop it before it gets to the hysterical level. Now it will be a police case, and she'll need a lawyer. Does she think the lawyer will do the work first before taking the money? Does the midwife wait to get paid? Even when the baby dies, the midwife collects her fee. But I wash my hands of her. That family and their dirty money. Haram ka pesa.
She smiled.
What the one leg should do is tell the police, I was born Hindu and these Muslims taunted me and set me on fire because I'm Hindu. Then these guys would be inside the prison forever.
It was 8 p.m. now. The sky above the Maidan purple as a bruise. Everyone had decided that when Fatima's husband returned from his garbage sorting work, he could take his wife to the hospital. The adults drifted back to their dinners, while a few boys waited to see if Fatima's face would come off. That had happened to a woman who had rented a room from Asha. The woman's husband had left her, and she, unlike Fatima, had torched herself thoroughly. The woman's charred face skin had stuck to the floor, and Rahul claimed that her chest had sort of exploded and that you could see straight through to her heart. Chapter 7 The Come Apart. Fatima's hair, what was left of it, had pulled free of the coil into which she put it before striking the match. Her face was now black and shiny, as if an artist commissioned to lacquer the eyes of a statue of Kali had gotten carried away and done the whole face. There was no mirror in Burn Ward No. 10, Cooper Hospital, the large hospital serving the poor of Mumbai's western suburbs. But she didn't need to see herself to know that she was bigger. The swelling was part of it, but there were other ways in which the fire had increased her. Leaving Anawadi, her spindly husband carrying her on his back, she'd started to be treated as a mattering person.
What have I done to myself?
She had cried out to sympathetic bystanders near the Hyatt.
But it is done now, and I will make them pay.
No auto rickshaw driver had wanted to transport a woman in such a state as she, given the potential damage to seat covers. But three young men had intervened, getting her to the hospital by threatening a driver with his life. And here at Cooper, where fluorescent lights buzzed like horseflies, she continued to feel like a person who counted. Though the small burn ward stank of fetid gauze, it was a fine place compared to the general wards, where many patients lay on the floor. She was sharing a room with only one other woman, whose husband swore he hadn't lit the fateful match. She had her first foam mattress, now sopping with urine. She had a plastic tube in her nostrils, attached to nothing. She had an IV bag with a used syringe sticking out of it, since the nurse said it was a waste to use a fresh syringe every time. She had a rusty metal contraption over her torso to keep the stained sheet from sticking to her skin. But of all the new experiences Fatima was having in the burn ward, the most unexpected was the stream of respectable female visitors from Anawadi. The first to come had been her former best friend, Cynthia, whom Fatima blamed for her current situation. Cynthia's husband had run a garbage trading business that failed as the Hussein's business prospered, and Cynthia had encouraged Fatima to do something dramatic to prompt a police case against the family that had bested her own. This had been terrible advice, Fatima saw belatedly, though the banana lassi Cynthia brought had been good. Zerunisa came too. Fatima caught a glimpse of her one morning, cowering just outside the room. Then four other neighbors appeared, led by Asha. Fatima felt honored that Asha had come. At Anawadi, the Shiv Sena woman looked right through her. Now, proffering sweet lime juice and coconut water, Asha whispered into Fatima's blackened ear. She reminded Fatima that what had happened between her and the Husseins had been seen by hundreds of people on the Maidan, and that Fatima ought not to tell lies about being beaten or set on fire.
What's the point of having such gamand, such ego?
Asha wanted to know.
Your skin is burned. You've done this stupid thing. And still your heart is full of vengeance?
Asha was trying to broker a truce that would avoid a police case. If Fatima would admit that the Husseins hadn't attacked her, Zerunisa would pay for a bed in a private hospital and settle some money on Fatima's daughters. Fatima understood that Asha intended to take a commission from Zerunisa for the settlement. She was burned, not mental. But it was too late to tell the truth. She'd already made her accusations to the police. On arrival at Cooper, Fatima had said that Karam, Abdul, and Kekashan had set her on fire. The account that had propelled officers into Anawadi after midnight to arrest Karam, as Abdul hid in his garage next door. But by the next morning, the Sahar police had learned that Fatima's statement was untrue. Her 8-year-old daughter, Nuri, had been especially clear in her account, that she'd watched through a hole in the family hut as her mother set herself on fire. If a charge against the Husseins was going to stick, and money from the family extracted, a more plausible victim statement was required. In order to help Fatima make such a statement, the police had dispatched a pretty, plump government official to Cooper. A woman with gold-rimmed designer eyeglasses who had left Fatima's bedside shortly before Asha arrived. Purnima Paik Rao, a special executive officer of the government of Maharashtra, was commissioned to take the hospital bed statements of victims. Gently, she helped Fatima construct a new account of the events that led to her burning. Even when Fatima had admitted that she couldn't read over what the officer had written, nor sign her own name at the bottom, the woman in the gold-rimmed glasses had remained respectful. A thumbprint would be fine. As the special executive officer understood, inciting a person to attempt suicide is a serious crime in India. The British had written the criminal code, and their strict anti-suicide provisions were designed to end the Hindu tradition of families pushing widows onto the funeral pyres of their dead husbands, a practice that relieved the families of the expense of feeding the widows. In the new account, Fatima admitted to burning herself, then carefully apportioned the blame for the self-immolation. She accurately reported Kakashan's curse at sundown about twisting off her other leg. She accurately reported Karam's threat about beating her and his demand that her husband pay for half the wall that divided their huts. She didn't mention Zerunisa, who had the best possible alibi, having been in the police station when Fatima burned. Instead, Fatima put the weight of her accusation on Abdul. Abdul Hussein had threatened and throttled her, she said in her statement. Abdul Hussein had beaten her up. How could you bring down a family you envied if you failed to name the boy in that family who did most of the work?
As my left leg is handicapped, I could not retaliate at them. In anger, I put the kerosene lying in my house on myself and set myself on fire, her statement concluded.
Special Executive Officer Purnima Paik Rao added to her account,
Record made under clear light of tube light.
And departed the hospital room to begin her real work. With this improved witness statement, and several other witness statements she hoped to influence at Anawadi, she thought she could make a handsome profit from the Husseins. By Fatima's third day at the public hospital, the blackened skin on her face had puckered, turning her almond-shaped eyes into rounds. She looked surprised, as if she hadn't known, lighting the match, what would happen.
The more I talk, the more I hurt, she said to her husband,
who stood at her bedside. Despite the pain, she felt compelled to yell at him from time to time, though her voice was lower pitched than it had been. Her husband had always been shovel-faced, but now his face seemed to lengthen by the day. And while he had a garbage sorter's superior coordination, his stricken state turned him into a bumbler. Grinding Fatima's pills into powder, he seemed overwhelmed by the complexity of the physical task. He broke the bread he'd brought to feed her down to crumbs. She wasn't very hungry, which was fortunate. Food wasn't one of the amenities at Cooper, the 500-bed hospital on which millions of poor people depended. Nor was medicine.
Out of stock today, was the nurse's official explanation.
Plundered and resold out of supply cabinets was an unofficial one. What patients needed
families had to buy on the street and bring in. A small tub of silver sulfadiazine, the burn cream recommended by the doctor, cost 211 rupees and was finished in 2 days. Fatima's husband had to borrow money to replace it. As he applied the cream, he